The new year is here, and it's the perfect time to kickstart your meditation practice. The Morning Meditation for Women podcast has short, daily guided meditations that will help you start your day with intention and focus, and make it so easy to get you into the habit. Imagine feeling so much more calm and confident in 2025. Follow and listen to Morning Meditation for Women on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This one gets worn out, but it's Beethoven, modern day Beethoven, Paul McCartney song.
Yeah, whatever.
And it gets worn out, but, you know, it's only a day longer. And of the Christmas songs, I think it's my favorite.
Really?
I thought I'd share that with you.
I like the traditional hymns of Christmas.
Like,
O Come All Ye Faithful. No. O Come All Ye Faithful. Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Glory to the Newborn King.
Angels We Have Heard on High.
Yeah. How about The Little Drummer Boy?
Oh.
Hate that one.
Maybe the worst combination of sounds ever recorded.
Isn't that a religious hymn?
I don't know, but those kids.
Yeah, I think it is.
Those kids that sing it.
Rump-tum-tum.
They got the children's glee club of whatever singing that thing. It drives me crazy. I can't stand it.
Junior, you like, I don't mind it. What about the one where they answer back about, do you hear what I hear?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, you're supposed to yell back at me.
Oh, Holy Night is great. Another profoundly
third voice. That third voice of Oh, Holy Night is the best.
Which one is that?
I don't know. We'll have to go back to it and
what
see
makes
if we
it
can
the
find
best?
It. I don't know. I thought it sounded different than the other two.
No.
You know what I mean?
They usually do.
Different key. Done in a different key.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of coming back for the second and third time, politics is interesting, right? You get to live through things and politics repeats itself. Several years ago, John, there was an effort called Better Together, which was a really well thought out effort to find a way to consolidate regional governance.
Tremendous amount of study put in.
Yeah, regional governance in the region. And essentially, the broad conclusion that was made was that we would be better as a region if St. Louis City and St. Louis County were united into one giant city. There's a number of issues that had to be dealt with that. It would create a city of almost 1.3 million people. Well, that went down in flames, Better Together did. Partly to blame because of the whole Steve Stenger situation, partly to blame for St. Louis's inability to want to make change and meeting change with a ball bat. Well, Ian Mackey, a state representative from Central St. Louis County, a Democrat, is proposing a piece of legislation in Jefferson City to essentially do through the legislative process in Jefferson City the same thing that was being attempted by Better Together, which is to merge the city and the county into one giant city. I think he's probably doing this for talking purposes and to get the conversation going. John, when we have a region that's spiraling the way that St. Louis is, people are grasping for answers and alternatives. But yet again, it's been proposed. The conversation's back out there. I've seen this movie, brother. I know how it ends.
Yeah. This particular proposal isn't going to get very far, but it's a conversation that is important. And, you know, I know there's a great deal of aversion by a great many people of merging the city into the county. Both governments right now are equally dysfunctional. You could certainly make that argument.
Right.
But it would do a number of things for the region. Right now, you've got 55 different police departments between the city and the county. And there's just no efficiency in that. And there's no cohesion to the law enforcement that we offer. And crime is arguably the most important thing in the region right now. This would potentially go a long way to solving that problem. The Los Angeles Police Department's unified. The New York Police Department's unified. I think there's real value in that. And then when you just look at the multiple numbers of duplicative government services that are offered, and we're all paying the cost of that.
Yeah.
So there would be some real savings and efficiencies in government if we were one government. And then even as far as optics are concerned, if you looked at the crime rate in St. Louis and included St. Louis City and county, it would still be high. But it would not be anywhere near the highest in the country.
No.
The problem with St. Louis City is nobody lives here. We're down to 270,000 people.
It's a hollowed out inner core to act a fool in.
So the crime rates, you know, are going
to
look horrible, and they do. So you know, you get at that issue, which is a public perception issue, which is not unimportant.
Yeah, and I think in terms of just attracting businesses to the region, having everything unified under one front, one single point of contact, that's going to be a big boost to those efforts.
Well, and that's one of the things you hear from contractors. You know, if you're going to build something in Maryland Heights and right next door in Olivet, I don't know if they neighbor each other or not.
They don't.
They would have different building codes, different rules as to what can be done. It just doesn't make any sense. So we see Ian Mackey, he's a left-of-center Democrat from Central County who's introducing this, John. It makes sense. It's a conversation that needs to take place. Maybe it will spur Jefferson City into realizing that this situation that's happening in our region ultimately may be something they can play a role in. But realistically, coming from the Democrats, this concept, as it has been met in the past, how do you think it fares?
Well, it's not going to fare well. And this isn't, you know, this has been attempted almost every decade since the 1950s.
Yep.
And there's been some mechanism expressed and developed where people, maybe the Board of Freeholders, it was a couple of times, this Better Together effort that you cited. And it seems like we as a community have this conversation at least once a decade. And the change required would be so massive, and St. Louisans, if we are known for anything, is that we're not the most acceptable of change.
Right.
And so there's that problem. But then, you know, when you look at the structure of the city of St. Louis and its government, if you were starting a government today from scratch, it would not look a thing like the way the city of St. Louis government is structured under its charter with a board of estimate and apportionment, whatever the heck that is. It's a three-headed monster that has to run the city. The mayor has power, but not that much in the city. And it's just, it doesn't work. And then when you put people in who may not be, you know, the best of the best among us, it
gets worse.
It gets worse.
Well, and it's decentralized power, and it was done that way when St. Louis was literally had a million people just in the city. They wanted to be able to decentralize some of the power. There was some gubernatorial fights going on related to the Civil War, etc. But you're exactly right. Now we sit here with 200 and a quarter people trying to figure out what's happening. And you're right. That conversation comes up every year. You know what conversation comes up every year as well? The population in the city continues to decrease, and the population in the region now is starting to decrease. So this is no longer just a city of St. Louis survival problem. It's arguably a problem that both sides of the rivers, both states ought to pay attention to, because the reason those suburbs exist is because of this city, and you can't survive being a suburb to nowhere.
Yeah, and the metropolitan area, the DMA, whatever you call the metropolitan, you know, we're losing ground there. We used to be in the top 20 in the country. We're not anymore.
No.
And so I think it's correctable. I think it's reversible.
I think so.
I think there's a lot that St. Louis offers that other cities don't. I look at a city like Pittsburgh, not as large in its metropolitan area as St. Louis is, but they've done a remarkable job with their downtown, cleaning things up, making things safer. Business is moving in there. There's a lot of flurry of activity in Pittsburgh. Great restaurants. We have great restaurants. And I see a city like that flourishing, and I think, you know, we could do that too.
Well, and we have. We did it in the 90s. We were growing as a city. You know, remember when Francis Slay first came in, all that investment in the downtown? It's dissipated now. But if you think of Nashville, Denver, the Austin, Texas, the cities that are growing, it's not growing in the suburbs. It's growing in the urban areas. I mean, how many St. Louisans are hopping in a plane or hopping in a car to go down to Nashville? It's not like they're hanging out in the Chesterfield of Nashville. No, they're going down to Broadway.
And one of the things that always throws me is when I'm downtown with my dad, he knows all the streets, knows where everything is, and it blows me away because, number one, he's usually not great with directions, but number two, I couldn't tell you where anything is downtown because the only time I've ever come here has been for a Cardinals game, a Blues game, a Rams game back in the day, or occasionally going to Ballpark Village.
And, John, I don't think that's a unique situation for most St. Louisans. I think there's a vast majority of people that the only time they come to the city of St. Louis or to downtown is for a sporting event.
Oh.
And that's not sustainable either. I mean, you've got to have commerce, and part of that starts with safety and security. And there's always been this focus in the past. Some people have called it, you know, various isms. But you've got to have a safe central core, and you work out from there and create business opportunities. And I think what we've seen from, look no further than 4th of July that's gone down here, we don't have a safe inner core. We have a lawless inner core.
Yeah, it's really bad. And, you know, this used to be when I was young and virile, and I was taking a date out, it would be typical for me to come down to the Landing and go to Hannigan's or Mississippi Nights, you know, find a restaurant in a really special time. You take them maybe to Tony's.
Yeah.
And which now is in Clayton. And you just don't, it's just not that kind of a destination anymore for people. But it could be. It could be. I mean, all of us have cars. And if you put cool stuff here, I think people would come, but you've got to solve the crime problem.
Well, and hopefully that will be a focus of our regional leadership. It surely isn't at this point. You said it, John. We have the bones that can make the changes here. Hopefully we'll be able to put together. Kudos to Representative Mackey for bringing this conversation up. This is the second time I've talked about this week. And I hate being the wet blanket, as I think you've been, John, as well, of telling people that that's maybe tough to do simply because we've experienced it in the past. But there is going to come a time, maybe sooner rather than later, where this decision of merging city and county won't be an option. It may be a necessity. He's John Hancock. I'm Michael Kelly. When we come back, wait till you hear what's going on with Social Security. We'll talk about it here on KMOX. That guy over there is John Hancock. I'm Michael Kelly. We are joined in studio by one of our former professors. He is Professor Dave Rosen. Dave. Economics professor at University of Missouri, St. Louis.
He's also a senior research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research.
And we're going to talk to him about...
Well, this bill that just passed in the debt ceiling thing the other day made a change to Social Security policy that was originally came out of the 1983 Reagan-era reforms of Social Security. What did Congress do, and what is your concern about it?
Well, what Congress did is they basically repealed something that was put into place in 1983 to deal with what was viewed at the time to be an unfair byproduct of the tiering of replacement rates and income. And I know that sounds pretty arcane, so let me just give you a little bit of background on how it works. The way Social Security works is that they figure out what your monthly income is under Social Security covered years, and then they replace it. They don't replace all of it. But if you're a poor person, so that number's going to be fairly low, it gets replaced at a rate of 90%, which makes sense. A poor person's going to need pretty much everything that they were making. If you make a little more money than that, they'll replace that first bit at 90%, but the next bit is at 32%. If you make even more than that, then that next bit is at 15%. So it's rather like the flip of an income tax, where the first so many dollars you pay at a relatively low rate, the next and so on. And it creates the same effect, though, because it means that people who make a ton of money don't, it isn't as generous a program for them. And everybody's okay with that. I mean, I don't know if that's the best way to do it, but that's how they do it.
And that was done in 1983 because the program was on a collision course to run out of money.
Well, the tiering has been there from the beginning.
Oh, it has? Okay.
Yeah. The tiering has been there from the beginning. It was an attempt to make the program more generous for the poor. The problem comes in when you have people who, and this used to be very common. It isn't common anymore. It's pretty rare now, but it was very common before the 80s for people to work in government or kind of semi-government, like university professors at a lot of schools and so on, to get a very generous pension but not get Social Security. And that was just part of the deal. And the reason why they didn't balk at that is they didn't have to pay Social Security taxes either.
Right.
Which is a nice thing. So that wouldn't be an issue if there if a person started right out of college, took a job as a university professor where they have a dedicated pension and a waiver on Social Security, go all the way to 65. That's all fine. And if somebody has a regular job like most of us do where we do pay into Social Security and we never have that kind of job, that's all fine. There's no issue. The issue comes in when somebody works at a place like, say, they're a fireman and they work until they're, say, 50, which you can understand because of the physical demands of the job. They usually don't keep at it. And then they turn around and they've got a pension that is not covered by Social Security.
Right.
And then they take another job, which is fine. And that job is a job like we're used to. It's called covered employment. We do pay Social Security taxes. Well, in that case, you end up with a weird situation, and it has to do with how the Social Security is computed, because that person is going to have another 15 years of earning if they go to 65, where they're paying into Social Security. So the reason why there was so much confusion among people in Congress is the people who are selling this repealing of the WEP provision, the windfall exclusion provision, were selling it in a vague kind of way of, well, these people are getting cheated out of their Social Security, and this is going to restore them. That's not the case at all. It's just simply not true. People get Social Security based on years that they pay in. You don't get Social Security for years you don't pay.
And in your example, the firefighter has got a pension, and probably a pretty good one.
Right.
And so now they pay into Social Security for 10, 12, 15 years. And what Congress is doing is treating them as if they had paid into it the entirety of their work life, right?
Actually, that's not it either. I mean, it's incredibly bizarre, and this is exactly why we ended up with such a weird result.
Uh-huh.
The problem is Social Security bases your pension benefit on the top 35 years that you paid in. Well, if you were a fireman that worked as a fireman until you were 50 and didn't pay into Social Security for them, you're only going to have like 15 years. So that's going to be 15 years of data plus another 20 years of zeros.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, when you use that number and then calculate the average monthly earnings based on 20 years of zero plus 15 of income, it's going to look like you're poor. Well, since you're poor, you're going to get a 90% recovery rate on your Social Security. What that means then is somebody who makes a lot of money and has a great pension, who works right next to somebody who was hired the same day he was and has no pension or a trivial pension, they're going to get exactly the same Social Security, because the guy who had a tremendously large pension was treated as though he was poor and therefore
gotcha.
Gets the high recovery
right. Okay.
It's subtle.
Right.
And I just think I don't think that there was chicanery going on.
Nobody flagged it. I mean, this wasn't really flagged by Congress. It passed overwhelmingly in the House.
Right.
And I noticed some senators yesterday taking victory laps about this very issue.
Yes. A large number of Republican senators voted for it. And I think they just simply did not understand what the WEP provision was for. So it really wasn't. What it was doing is it was trying to make sure that people who made a ton of money didn't get reimbursed at a more generous rate than people who made less money, which is what ended up happening.
We got to let you go in just a little bit. Is Social Security solvent?
Is it solvent?
Is it gonna make it?
Well, if we don't change anything, the trust fund will empty out. And it depends on what we do, but
right.
It's probably about 2035. But that ends up not really mattering either, because the trust fund is actually kind of phony. Right now, as we are redeeming the bonds in the trust fund, these bonds were special issue bonds from the government to itself, which means in order to redeem the bond from the Treasury has to run out and borrow money anyway.
Right.
So it makes no difference. It was a complete mirage. Well, you can't argue that the trust fund was a mirage, but then when the trust fund empties out, a terrible thing's going to happen. What was a mirage all the way?
Right.
So I think that's – right now we have a very bad situation with Social Security. Luckily, there's a few types of reforms that are not that draconian that can pretty much put Social Security on good footing. if we did just two things, we could pretty much get rid of the unfunded liability problem. One is in that initial calculation I told you about where they figure out your average monthly income. There's an adjustment made there because people work over a very long period of time, so you have to adjust for differences in price levels over that time. And they use a wage inflation adjustment measure in there. And that is something that makes the benefits grow faster over time. The problem with Social Security is not that it doesn't pay enough. It's that it's paying ever more in real terms year after year.
And we're living longer.
Right. And it's been doing that. And the problem with that is wages grow at the rate, roughly at the rate of the economy. And if you have real income gain in a society, that means wages rise faster than inflation.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is if you are going to index it by wages, you can't ever grow out of the problem because you're going to be paying out benefits so much more generally that it's not going to make it.
He is David Rose. He's a professor, emeritus professor of economics at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and he's a senior research fellow with the American Institute for Economic Research. Dave, thanks for being with us. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
The news is next.
Well, here's a sign that you're old. Merry Christmas. Hancock Kelly sitting in for the DGS. We'll take you up to the 5 o'clock news with Michael Calhoun.
Yes.
We got the NFL Insider coming up for you. But last night I'm watching the football games, and they kept previewing something on 60 Minutes. I almost texted you. I forgot to do it.
Thanks.
I had told you before that I thought a good plot for a movie would be this story of how the pagers blew up in Iran all at one time.
Lebanon.
Yeah. Right. So did you guys see the 60 Minutes story last night?
No, I did not.
So here's what happened. They interviewed two of the guys from the Israeli secret intelligence.
Okay.
Mossad.
And they told the story about how they had originally started to do this with walkie-talkies. And for 10 years, they had been selling them the same walkie-talkies that they would have and that they would blow up at some point. And then later they engineered this pager that was used, and they had to come up with fake videos and stuff to sell it to them. So they created a fake company in Singapore. They did a hard sales job to these guys.
And these were the leaders of Hezbollah.
They get them to sign up for a larger pager than that would be typically have. You know, like it was just a little bit larger. And so what happens is they believed, long story short, they believed they were going to get exposed that they had done this. And this went on over several years. Remember, the walkie-talkies were done over 10 years.
Yeah.
So these pagers were done over several years. They thought they were going to be exposed. They blew them all up on one day. And then when they realized we weren't going to get exposed, but now they're looking into us, the walkie-talkies that they had for 10 years, they blew those up like 3 days later and took a bunch of people out as well.
Wow.
They went down to testing these pagers to the precise way that they would explode so that it would be in your face. And if your kid was sitting with you, next to you or whatever, it wouldn't hit them. And so the videos we see of it exploding on people's legs and stuff, it was all a directional explosion, but it was planned over 10 and 15 years.
That's incredible.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible.
And
I was wondering, it had to be manufactured that way, right?
Right.
So they actually create a phony company. And then
several.
And then market their products to the terrorists.
Right. And you'll have to go back and watch the story. There was something specific to the company that they used in Singapore had already had a relationship with Hezbollah. So they were doing that, and then they set up a company in Hungary, and it was all a big mixed match game so that they didn't know where it was coming
shell
from.
Shell companies.
And they had to sell them on, hey, you don't want the small, you know, pager. You want the bigger one. And so they later come back and get these guys to buy in on this pager. It was an incredible story, worth watching. And they asked the guy, one of the people who was the spy that kind of helped put this together, and he says, how do you feel about this morally? And he said, well, you know, essentially something along the line of war is war, and I can guarantee you they're worried about what we're up to next.
Yeah. I mean, Mossad compared to, you know, Hezbollah, that feels a little bit like when an FCS school comes to play Georgia or Alabama. Mossad's outclassing them there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Israeli intelligence is incredible. I mean, truly incredible. And which is all the more reason that they missed October 22nd, whatever day that was, when the
right,
because they completely missed, their intelligence community missed that. And that, the tale of that, how that was missed, is something I'm going to be fascinated to find out. And I don't think we'll find out until, you know, after this war is over, and probably not until after Netanyahu's successor is in office.
Well, they said last night, and maybe this was a bit of puffery by CBS. Did you like that word, puffery?
Fairness.
That it was a bit of puffery, but they said that this could have been like the tipping point that started the start of the fall of Syria, etc. It was when these alliances realized that they were vulnerable on their own side. They asked this one particular agent a question, and he said that the head guy for Hezbollah was clearly frazzled the next morning when he gave his speech, and they showed giving his speech. And they said the reason he was frazzled is one of those pagers blew up in somebody's hand next to them. And they said, how do you know that? He goes, we were there.
Yeah.
Right. Think about that.
Yeah.
That's got to be scary if you're the bad guy and they blew up your own personal pagers.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't get you, but they were smart enough to do it once. They can get you again.
Yeah, they were there and they saw it happen.
Uh-huh. And they were there.
Smart. Well, we got to the bottom of that. What we haven't gotten to the bottom of is who's going to win the championship in the National Football League. Our NFL insider joins us after this on The Voice of St. Louis, KMOX. It is a clash of grizzled veterans and youthful warriors. It is a series of full contact violent exchanges between large gladiators, played out as a drama in front of a watching world. As we prepare for the playoff season, will it be the Kansas City Chiefs, the Buffalo Bills, the Detroit Lions, or the Green Bay Packers, who take home the trophy named in honor of Vince Lombardi in the National Football League? And our NFL insider is here to join us, John Hancock from Chicago, Illinois.
How about that, Michael? Happy to be here.
It's a great intro every time.
It is. The NFL, we're getting down to the home stretch now. A lot of my preseason predictions not looking so hot, but I did give the people won that Trevor Lawrence is the biggest fraud in the NFL.
Really?
Title previously held by Baker Mayfield.
Baker Mayfield, who lost last night. But
he did lose last night, but, you know, he's been humbled, and you know, he's had a strong season, gotten the Bucs in contention in the very weak, to be fair, NFC South.
Yeah, and so they're going to make it, right, the Bucs, it looks like?
Probably, yeah. They're sitting in a good spot. The Chiefs continue to get helped out by their friends, the Zebras, the Pinstripes, the referees. It's tough to win a 2-on-1 anywhere, especially at the highest level of professional sports. The Bills, I want them to do it. I think America wants them to do it. But I don't know if anyone's going to be able to take down the Chiefs and the refs this year.
Really?
I think it's a tailor-made three-peat, and hope I'm wrong.
I hope you're wrong, too. Do you think there's no chance that an NFC team can take this thing?
The Lions are banged up. The Packers, I think, are, you know, a year or two out still. The Eagles, I mean, Jalen Hurts just got knocked out with a concussion. We don't know how that's going to impact them. I do think there is one glimmer of hope. There's one man who's beaten Patrick Mahomes in the playoffs. It's not Tom Brady when it's mattered most. And the Cincinnati Bengals, left for dead by many. Yes. Sheriff Joe Burrow. They're sitting at 7 wins. They have to win out. They need some help. They need the Broncos and Colts to lose. But if the Cincinnati Bengals make it, there's one team Patrick Mahomes and the referees at Arrowhead do not want to see, and that is Joe Burrow and the Cincinnati Bengals. They'll put up 40 on you. And you just got to hope they can hold the Chiefs to 38.
So the Chiefs, I'm with you. I think the Chiefs are headed towards a three-peat, and I'm kind of rooting for them, even though I'm not normally a Chiefs fan. I guess my question to you would be, knowing that they're not as good as they used to be, who's the MVP of this league?
The MVP, I think Josh Allen. I mean, Lamar Jackson's actually putting together a better year this year than he did last year when he won the award.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to – I think he's going to have to clear a high hurdle, Lamar, to get that third MVP. But I think Josh Allen has been incredibly productive. Numbers are actually, I think, slightly down, but he's been less careless this year than he has in years past. I think Josh Allen's going to get this award, and more just out of an obligation. Like, he hasn't gotten one, probably deserves one.
Well, there's a guy that's been benefited by the addition of Derrick Henry. I think Derrick Henry has been much more transformational for that Buffalo Bill club than he's been given credit for.
Well, as the Baltimore Ravens.
The Baltimore Ravens.
No, that's been a massive, massive boost to Lamar and Coach Harbaugh.
So do you think the Ravens have a shot?
I don't think the Ravens have a shot, unfortunately. Lamar, he plays well, except against the Kansas City Chiefs, the Pittsburgh Steelers, and in the playoffs. He did just beat the Steelers, though, so maybe Lamar can clutch up this year and get it done.
He is John Hancock,
yes,
Jr. He is our NFL insider, kind enough to spend some time with us today.
He actually knows that Derrick Henry plays for the Baltimore Ravens.
You coming back tomorrow?
I think so.
He'll be back in studio with us tomorrow. That's John Hancock over there. I'm Michael Kelly. We want to wish you a Merry Christmas. Happy Christmas Eve. The DGS will be back at it tomorrow with Hancock and Kelly.
Yeah, we will. And stick around. Total Information PM starts in just a minute. Our own Michael Calhoun will take you on the drive home right here on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.